Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. From our Providence, Rhode Island studios, I sit down with talk radio host, Matt Allen. Matt Allen is the midday host on Providence radio station, News Talk 630 and 99.7 FM, WPRO, and has been a fixture of Rhode Island's political airwaves for nearly two decades. We talked about Matt's broadcasting career, which included working with former Providence Mayor Buddy Cianci, election 2018 results, the future of local media, and Matt offers an unapologetic take on how progressives can improve their message to appeal to a broader sector of the voting population. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the Bartholomew Town Podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you may find each of our in-depth interviews with Rhode Island politicians, media members, artists, and beyond at BartholomewTown.com. All right, let's get right to it with WPRO's Matt Allen. All right, so here we are anticipating what hopefully won't be the first storm of this.
Ugh.
Yeah, I can't handle it.
No.
let's not even go there. Let's make this time irrelevant, weather irrelevant.
All right. Why not? It's not happening. It's very nice outside. Everything is good.
Beautiful day. Birds are
that's right.
Singing here in Elmwood.
Yes.
Matt Allen, WPRO.
Yes, sir.
Midday host. I guess was your
midday.
I guess,
yeah,
that's
works,
your slot.
Yeah.
This
yep.
kind of.
Yep.
And you've been with WPRO since, or the company since '99, as it shifted from Citadel
yeah,
and so forth.
Yeah. I worked at WPRO. I started off as an intern on the FM side. Yep. Well, first for promotions in the winter of 1999, and then. The following September, I started working part-time for WPRO, and at the same time, over that summer, I was interning for Gio and Kim in the morning on Pro FM, where they gave me unbelievable access to the microphone, man. It was those guys, I will forever love them. They gave me the ability to do all kinds of stuff. We did bits. We went to Woodstock 99 and reported from there, sleeping in the filth, in the waste, literally.
Yeah.
it was like a refugee camp. It was brutal. But fires and chicanery of all kinds. And then after that, I started working part-time on WPRO. They needed a promotions manager after that, so I started working there. And I hated it. Hated doing the promotions. Hated it with a passion. I wanted to be on the air. I wanted to be or affect the air product in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
And then Ron St. Pierre said, listen, they want to cut the promotions position for WPRO for right now. Combine it with something else. We need you on the programming side. Come on over. So that's when I started doing producing and the rest is history.
Yeah, the rest is history as you basically navigated several shows that occupied that time before getting your own show, one of which was the late former mayor, Buddy Cianci's. Is that correct?
When he was on, I was Steve Cass's producer, and for a while, the months between when he got convicted and when he was sentenced, it was probably, I want to say he was convicted in the summer, and I want to say it was probably after he got his sentencing, I want to say September, if I remember correctly, the fall-ish.
Yep.
From then till Christmas, right before, I think it was either right before Christmas, he was sent to prison. And so those couple of months, he co-hosted the show with Steve Cass in the last hour of his show. So I could spend every day, the last hour of the show with Buddy Cianci in the studio, and it was weird, man. And then he came back and worked with us after that, and when I had seen him, used to call me the Amish kid because of my beard. He's like, oh, you're an Amish kid. And so he would, he actually, when he came back and got out of prison, he came back for the first time to see us and he saw me. He's like, oh, and he remembered me. And at that point I had my own show and everything. So things had changed over the 5-6 years that he was away. And it was interesting. It was a weird transition type thing, but I got a glimpse into the two Cianci's that, I think it was Judge Fortunato was the time. I think it was Judge Torres, I believe, who the judge who really in his sentencing talked about the two Buddy Cianci's, the great right. guy, the philanthropist, the guy, but then also the guy who will turn on you, get angry. It really was such a true characterization of him. I mean, he was that way.
And you saw that in studio.
Not to the other extent that other people had, but I saw that dark side a few times, small glimpses to it, and you can more likely I could see how that dark side existed and things that he said a couple of times. I was like, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
Very transactional. He said something to me one time. I got married and I didn't invite him to my wedding. He wasn't too happy about that. He wasn't like overly upset about it. When he right. saw me, he's like, boss, you should have invited me. I would have given you a G note. And he kind of walked by and I'm like, oh, well, I don't want it to be a circus. So it was just friends and family, you know? So
right.
It was interesting stuff like that. Like there was you had to pay a certain level of homage. And if he didn't, it was kind of bothersome to him. So it was interesting.
That's really interesting. Yeah, you feel like the transactional aspect of Cianci's life is really the defining way to look at him.
It's the way he ran everything, right? But then also it's kind of sad, too, because at the end you wonder, do you have any really, you know, genuine people in your life that don't use you or allow themselves to be used by you, you know? I always wondered that. It was kind of a sad, almost a tragic story where I'm sure he had a couple of family members who really loved him and who he really loved. But
right.
I always wondered, you know, a guy like him, you'd think he'd be surrounded by those people. But I don't know if he was.
Right. Yeah. You wonder who was really there for him as it all collapsed at the soulfulness level. You know, who really said, I know the real Vincent Cianci, you know, Junior and
I hope he had
nurtured
at least a couple of people that were just all that the mayor stuff didn't matter. And it was just grandpa or dad or, you know, buddy or whoever, you know?
Yeah. Or ultimately, was it a fiance situation here where there was like a lawsuit to try to get a portion of shit?
I don't even know. I don't know what the end of the end game was for that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what that was, but that was odd.
Yeah.
A lot of odd stuff there.
There's plenty of odd stuff.
Quite a story there. Yes.
In that one. Yeah. Especially, now with Dee Dee Whitman running and everything that, you know, resurfaced in a way, very marginally for sure, but that name is just not going to go away. And it seems like the dark side of it's more carries more weight now than the positive side of Buddy.
Yeah, I think that when people in Providence, you know, not that I can speak for them, but it's when people in Providence talk about the Buddy years, I think they're talking more about pragmatism than they are about. I think you have Jorge Alorza, who tends to be an ideologue and a philosophical left wing guy, you know, and he thinks his job as mayor is to promote those ideas, you know, about sanctuary city and inclusiveness and blah, 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 which all sound great. But Buddy was about clean the streets, make sure you can get by, make sure that the people's potholes are filled and, you know, do what you got to do to make sure that everybody, the administration part of the city was getting done, and then go out and sell the city. Forget ideology, make it work. And that's what matters, to make the city work, because then it allows you to stay in office to do more things to make the city work.
Yeah, that's sort of the question about what actual role in terms of administration the mayor plays. It's a back and forth.
Yeah.
Obviously, the residents of Providence approve of where things are going to the extent that they, you know, 75 to 78 precincts went Alorza. Yeah. All right, let's go back. Something you mentioned also struck me is that you were working off the air for radio and you just felt that need to be contributing to production, contributing to the on-air side of things. Mm-hmm. I've felt that as well. Working, mm-hmm. I hate working in sales and things like this. It's dreadful. And particularly when you're in a situation where you want to be a part of the talent, if you will.
Yeah.
So you finally got your own show, if you will, after working in the back offices, working as a producer. What year was that, Matt Allen Nation?
My own show. Well, first I started where I had a partner on Saturdays. We did a show called Mental Floss. Me and Jen Brian, who was also a producer there. It was right after 9/11. I think it was probably the end of September, beginning of October in 2001. The boss said, Ron St. Pierre was the boss at the time, said we need more local programming, especially after the terrorist attack. There's going to be stuff happening on the weekends. We need more people. So we did a show together for a while, a couple of years. And then eventually Jen stopped doing it. She wanted to do other things. So I said, I always wanted to do it myself. So give me the show on Saturday by myself. So I did that for a couple of years. And then I want to say there was a couple of years that the Dan York show was, I was his producer for a long time. I think probably 7-8 years. There was a time where he had 4 hours. And then they had another hour before they went to go to syndicated shows. I think it was 7 to 8 or something like that. His show was 2 to 6, and I was 6 to 7. They had that 1 hour. They said, well, let's try and give it to Matt. So I'd do his producer's show and then host my own hour for a little while. And then when it was 2007, the boss, Paul Giamarco, and Barbara Haynes, who was our general manager, decided they wanted to go to the corporate and say, we want to take the FM signal and simulcast WPRO and 99.7. And
that was the score at the time?
I think that, yeah. I'm trying to remember the timeline. I think the score had it for a while. Then they switched it to music or something for a little bit. Or maybe that was beforehand. But they had this FM signal that was not doing anything. They weren't doing anything with it.
Yep.
So, or nothing of value at that point anyway. So then they swapped it over to us. And now, ever since then, we do the simulcast. And in an effort to create a bigger buzz and a more local programming and all that stuff, they added me on from 6 to 9 at night to kind of take that into the next level.
And that kind of gave birth to the 6 to 9 slot that still exists today.
Yeah, yeah. And it was something I was very proud of because I built it from nothing. I mean, there was no major audience to speak of. And, you know, at nighttime and people are... You know, you go to national programming, stuff like that. I mean, we had some listeners, but it was people like, yeah, okay. It was kind of they shut the day down for a while, the Rhode Island day anyway, at 6 o'clock and wait till the morning. So it was a really cool audience. It was all mine. We had such a bond. It was, I think we did anyway. I love that show. I miss it. Miss the time slot, and I miss the crazy people that listened at the time would call me. We had a lot of fun.
Yeah, that sounds like, just hearing you speak of it, it sounds like an entirely different radio show than the Matt Allen show, the midday show.
It's had to change a little bit, and it's had to be a little bit more serious, I think. I don't know if I had to, but I feel like I've had to. And I can't get away with a lot of stuff that I was doing at night. Not that I was doing anything that controversial, just the way you talk, it was more loose. We get into a little bit more adult stuff, you know, and talk more frankly about it, quite frankly, than, you know, during the day there's... during the day, you know, the stuff you do at night you don't do during the day. So it was more of a hangout type of session type of thing, you know.
You went to Rick, right? Renown College. And did you work for the station there? Is it XRQ? Is it the station?
WXIN at the time. I think it's WXIN.
I think it still is then.
It was literally like a 1 watt. It didn't make it off college campus. You have to go, you leave Rick, you didn't see, you didn't hear it. God, I hope there's no tapes left anywhere of it, because I don't have any. And it was awful. And I had no idea what I was doing. It was just me and my buddy talking about stupid things and doing fake PSAs and just dumb things. But it was there's something, that thrill of cracking that microphone and knowing there's people out there that you don't know who are listening. You have no idea.
It's magical.
It's weird. It's a thing. And once, I think broadcasting obviously is going to be usurped by the internet and streaming and whatnot. But there's a magic to it that will be lost, I think, if it ever just goes away.
There is. There's no question about it. I still feel like when I see radio towers, even out there and where you guys are in East Providence and things like that, there's actually an image that someone tweeted, you know, something like that, of in your station, in your studio, of like a photo of the tower with the W, in the old school WPR logo. I was like, man, I want that poster on my wall. That's because that's a specific feeling. That's something that maybe I'm the last like bracket of people, 30s, late 20s, that... The radio mattered, but it mattered to me here a lot growing up. 95.5 WBRU.
Oh, yeah.
What I grew up in the woods. What would I do without that transmitter? You know,
sure,
and also that gatekeeper. You know, serving as the limitations are negative, and you have that freedom now. But man, there's something about just having a source.
Yeah, it was like we culled it for you. Only the best of the best can be here, or you know, whatever. Not that was really the truth. That was the perception, anyway. And you had standards, and there's an old school engineer that doesn't work there anymore. He retired, but he used to say to me, what comes out of the speakers matters. So from everything, it was from the quality of your words, to the quality of your diction, to the quality of the sound, the quality of the audio you play, everything matters. And so act like it matters. In the world of deconstruction that we live in, where you know, break all the rules and those things don't matter, quality, I think, takes a hit. And I say that a lot, that we have a crisis of quality.
Mm-hmm.
In general, in everything, in all parts of our society right now.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, there's a lot of shortcuts, you know, in there's a lot of systems that have been devised to bypass the traditional ways of doing things, but what's lost in that is the process and the experience of getting to the end, you know.
There's something kind of cool, like I have a Sea Crane radio at home, right? It's got the weather bands and all this stuff.
Yeah.
There will be times where I'll just sit there late at night and I'll just have it on my lap, and you can catch stations from all over the place just to see what you can grab, what's floating around in the air out there, you know?
Right.
You can sit outside in the woods near a campfire just with a radio and just, you know, go up camping up in the mountains. What can you listen to? Oh, it's Air America in Israel, or Radio Israel, or, you know, German radio station bouncing off the ionosphere. WBZs like heard all over the country in the middle of the night. So it's just like that part I'll miss. It's cool, you know.
It really is. Yeah, I wonder what year they'll stop putting radios in cars. That'll be the big, you know, when it's not there, it's not an option. That'll be the end.
Yeah.
I agree, though. You get, you know, for me, I listen to 660 WFAN, clear as a bell on the AM signal here in Providence. That's nuts, you know.
And it's built that way. You know, those signals are engineered. They're strong. They're ground, you know, based in ground conductivity. And so, like, where we are is like prime real estate because we have salt marsh where our towers are.
Yep.
So the signal really flows well through that whole area. And it's like, it's the signal's huge. It's such a big deal. Because it was all put up before environmental regulations allowed, so we're all grandfathered in. And so that's where you want, you know, that kind of scenario is like the best bet for radio signal. So that's the other thing, because you can have other more powerful radio stations that can't be heard as well as we can.
Right. It's all about topography and that map, looking at those maps, those charts of the signal and the odd shapes of the, I guess it's not a circle anymore when it looks like that.
The ground, like literally the makeup of the ground, the rock, the bedrock, all that stuff can all impact all that for AM anyway.
Yeah. Even FM. For FM, I think the way it impacts water certainly impacts the way
mountains, things like that. Yeah.
And other signals, of course, the hospital, the Navy base or whatever, it's going to, it's going to have something to do with it, I think.
Yeah.
But Joe Trillo could probably explain it to us based on...
Yeah. I can do any of this stuff. I'll build you one right now. Tin foil and gum.
What do you think about this last election? I mean, just in terms of covering it every day, no surprises, right? Not even the 50% mark?
Every time we have an election, there's the Charlie Brown part of me that thinks... There's going to be a surprise. Something weird's going to happen here. This is going to be the one where everybody goes, let's try something different. And like Charlie Brown, every time I have the football pulled out from in front of me and I fall on my ass. And for me, the first inclination of why this is going to be another one of those times was the primary. There wasn't even a sniff of an appetite for anybody to do it. If most of the time you have Democratic primaries, if Democratic primaries are not going to be doing anything interesting or anything different, you're not going to get anything in the general election. It was what it was. I was actually surprised at how low Trillo got. I thought he was going to get 10%.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have been surprised 17%. 4% was... It was a status quo. I really do think it was a Trump-driven election. You had a ton of extra voters come out, you know, 60,000 extra voters, whatever it was. I guarantee you, if you did a study on them, they were mostly women, and they were middle fingers in the air to Donald Trump, and that was it. If you were remotely tied to him, you went down too.
Yeah, we certainly saw that with Alan Fung. I feel like Alan Fung's campaign just didn't get it going at any point this year in a way to present. For example, if you go on, you know, go back on YouTube and look at his concession speech from 14 when the crowd starts booing when he, you know, says, I'm going to work with Governor-elect Raimondo, and he settles the crowd down. He gets emotional, you know, and then also the ice bucket challenge, just stupid stuff like this. There's elements where you go, oh, Alan Fung, hi, I could see us like hanging out and debating, you know, your idea of the unleashing a police force on the inner city versus my approach, that we could have that conversation, but at the end of the day, you're human. I feel like they turned him into this, they being his, whoever consultants and communications personnel that they got, they just turned him into this robotic, basically no opinion at all. It seemed like that's where you got.
You cannot underestimate how bad it is when you hide from the press. If they think you're hiding from them, or if they start reporting that you're not having any major press conferences or anything like that, if you can't defend your points, you can't stand up and debate your opponents, get the hell out. Just get out. Just be done with it. Especially Rhode Island, where you're already behind the eight ball as a Republican. You have to go out and convince Democrats and independents that you're worth crossing over to the dark side for. And that's their perception, not mine, of the dark side. That's what they think the dark side is around here. And if you don't want to go out there and ask for their vote and talk to them about it and through the media, you know. Alan Fung, for whatever reason, didn't come across or can't come across or just hasn't figured out how to come across as a person. It's more as a product than him.
Absolutely. Yep.
And he's a guy that I don't think is comfortable in that way. For whatever reason, I don't think he's comfortable being a product. And he was always uncomfortable. It wasn't until the end, when it's too late, that he kind of broke out and was like, blah, 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 blah. You know, the last debate he broke out. But, you know, he didn't, I don't think he did well with women in that debate, because women don't like it when you're aggressive and yelling and calling people names and stuff. Yeah, so he just didn't, he's got to figure, it's almost like, he's a grown man, so it's hard to even say this, he doesn't know who he is. And if he does know who he is, he's not comfortable in being who he is. So he tries to create this other thing, this product that's not him. And people, they won't be able to vocalize it, but they know it. They know it's not real.
I completely agree.
And so they distrust him. Yep. Like, there's something there. I don't know what it is. It's not right. So you're going to, you know.
I couldn't agree more.
Now, how do you fix that? People get paid a lot more money than I make to figure that out. I have no idea.
So, yeah, bring on.
Be real. Okay.
Yeah. Bring on whoever the governor has. I mean, because I feel like her campaign, you know, it shifted her more to me into a, even though she was distant and not more distant than Alan Fung from the media in a lot of ways, it seemed like she was, through her ads and her presentation, humanized a lot more, especially towards the end.
You think so? Yeah.
I felt that way. I felt like her smile was highlighted more and... Yeah. You know, the beer commercials and all that, that didn't really, I don't think that sold anybody particularly, but yeah. I think there was something there at the end that was sort of like, all right, it's Gina. Yeah, Gina, even just her logo, just the first name in cursive, something just familiar to somebody in Cranston who's going to vote.
I think she had so many things working for her. She had the economy working for her.
Yep.
She had, the Trump thing working for her. And so she didn't really have any hurdles to overcome other than her own unpopularity. And I think that what happened was people came out and they're like, all right, I'm just going to go for her then. And they just did, because they didn't want to change what's happening right now. And what's happened is people are working. People are working because the national economy is humming. It's the post-recession era. Rhode Island finally caught up, which it's always done. The thing is, we're first one in the recession, last one out. We finally got out. It was timed perfectly for her campaign. And her campaign had a lot of money. And she had the ground game. She had every resource she could possibly want. And it took $7 million for her to win this race.
That's insane.
It says something. She needed a lot of polishing and a lot of stuff.
Right.
But, hey, she won. She got the majority of the vote. And so that's, I think, good for the state in general. And you could tell it's good for her because she was crowing about that on election night. You know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was there at the Biltmore. Yeah. I mean, and they, both her and Mayor Alorza were, you know, they looked like they just won, you know, lifetime membership to the moon, you know,
essentially.
You know. I think they were optimistic about the 50% on the Raimondo side, but they were super excited about it when it came through.
Yeah, it's one thing to be optimistic about. It's another thing to actually get it, right? Yeah. And when you get it and you look at it, you go, okay. That's it. There's no more of this, you're a 40% governor nonsense.
Right.
I can say, I'm the governor and screw you. So, and I'm sure she will.
I bet. Absolutely. Yeah, in terms of the General Assembly and her relationship there, that's something that'll be interesting to keep an eye on. She'll have more might, more clout, so to speak. Let's just shift to the media here in Rhode Island. Obviously, you're a fixture in it now and have been for quite some time.
I don't feel like that, am I?
I think so. I think that, you know, I think that your role, your seat is a coveted one and is relative to, you know, anyone else out there. It's unique, including the other people on your station. So it fits into the ecosystem here that goes from everyone from a Steve Alquist and on that side through the 6, 10, and 12. But do you feel like, obviously, it's shrunk. There's only one major talk radio station now versus two before, the Projo shrinking, everything. But do you feel like the quality is still there? Obviously, this is a loaded question because there's a lot of people that we both respect who work in the media, but the average person in Rhode Island, are they being presented with fair and balanced news on a regular basis when it comes to the local level?
I think local level, yes. But I will tell you that there's a lot more constraints on the economic reality of the corporate culture that we all work in that makes it more difficult to, I mean, especially the Providence Journal. I mean, they still have phenomenal journalists there and they do great work, and but they do it in a limited fashion. It's just the reality of it. You know, they can put as much of a spin on it that they can and be like, you know, we're still doing that. Alan Rosberg does a good job of that, trying to, you know, trying to communicate his way through it. But it's just the reality of it. It just is what it is. And, you know, it's one of those things that I think gains momentum the further you go. So as you head down a hill, you go faster as you go down that hill. So it happens faster.
Yep.
I have to say, I think Channel 12 does a phenomenal job of, I don't know how they do it. They maintain a level of investment that I would imagine is unheard of across the country in local reporting, investigative reporting. And it's so important. And you have to have a corporate structure, excuse me, a local management structure that has enough understanding of that and care to fight the corporate structure to convince them to invest in that stuff. It's really hard because it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, the corporate bigwigs call the local management and say, I need 10% off the top. Go find it. And when you've already cut to the bone and you've already – and it's not because of you. You've made your money. You know, you're out there. You're making the money you're supposed to make. You're delivering on your budgets. You're popular. You have the ratings. You have the advertising revenue. But they own 300 other radio stations or television stations that aren't doing as well. And so – everybody needs to share the pain. It's tough. It's really tough. It's hard. And you also, you know, young people are smart. We need young people to be invested in the medium, and nobody wants to pay them. And nobody wants to pay dues and work for nothing for a long time before you can get your shot, if you get your shot. And so the kind of people that end up taking those jobs, this is a big criticism that's been made of the national news media, that because of the economics and because of what goes on and the kind of with places where national news media outlets make their money on social media and stuff, they hire people who are, they get their satisfaction not from a paycheck but from their ideology, from being a crusader, being a voice of the people rather than somebody going to get information today, being outrageous so they can get viral videos going so they can make more money on the social media. And it really impacts the quality, not the quality, it depends on what you're talking about, but the type of stories that are done, and I think the way the stories are done on a national level. Local level, I think they've done really well maintaining their credibility, and just because I know these people, I know them, I see them, and they really do a good job. But they have things that if you're nitpicking, like I nitpick, they love their pet stories. Stupid dog stories and cat stories and nonsense, and why people click on them. You know, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Who's going to get more clicks? A story about a dog being rescued from a grate with a video attached, or the budget for Providence? The never-ending news story about the horse barn that was the people that kept the horse barn in horrible disarray and that starving horses. You'd think that they just found like Jimmy Hoffa's grave, and you know what I mean. But those are the stories that click. Everybody likes to click on them. So
it's nuts. I completely agree. Do you think we'll ever get back to a point where the major stations or the major outlets are independently owned and operated at a local level?
Oh man, I don't know. I don't know. I have no idea. Would it be a good thing? We have a level of editorial control at my station where we do what we think is right and popular. We never get orders from anybody. Don't talk about this. It just doesn't happen. Now, if I had some local businessman who owned the radio station who had business over here and over there and who had a contract that was ready to go with a municipality and I was about to whack the mayor, would he call me and say, no, you're not talking about that? It's very possible. So there's a benefit to that, but at the same time, who would be a better steward of the quality of the air product? Somebody who is a person in the community who actually has reputations tied to it, or some corporate overlord who just looks at the bottom line and says, I don't care. Who cares if they have local live traffic that can you know, all day long, tell people what their roads are like. Doesn't matter. Cut it. We're going to do it out of Boston. We're going to, you know, whatever. You know, just as an example of some things that happens at radio stations. Or
sure, yeah. The weather, all of a sudden, it's, right. you know, Frank Strait, all of a sudden, out of right. nowhere.
Right.
Yep.
So it's like one of those things that, you know, it's a tough battle. But we've seemed to fare it so well because we do so well here. We, on a radio level, the corporation sees, like, wow, what the hell are they doing over there? It's
right.
a cultural thing. I think we just have a culture here where local radio will always, or local content, I should say, whether or not it's delivered over the air, over a wire, or whatever, local talk and local things about local issues is going to be popular.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And I think also the interactivity. I mean, we were the original social media, right? You got something you want to say, you got to post something, don't post it, call and show and talk about it, you know, and you get your opinion out there and you can talk back to the power brokers that normally will ignore you, get an unpopular opinion out there that nobody would ever actually hear because it's kind of wacky or whatever. I mean, we've broken stories, had stories leaked to you, stuff like that. We bring a lot of things out, get reaction, real reaction from people about real issues and, you know, real-time stuff from the weather, like if we're going to have a bad weather day. What's going on the roads out there? I mean, for all intents and purposes, the night of the December debacle, which was that freak snowstorm, which the whole state was frozen for, like, people were stuck in their cars for 9, 8, 9, 10 hours. Hmm. Kids couldn't get home from school in Providence till like 8 o'clock at night and whatever. I was the only one on the radio. I was filling in for Dan York because Dan couldn't get there, couldn't get to the studio. So here I was. I did the show, I think, from 2 o'clock in the afternoon till midnight. And I was the voice of emergency information to the entire state. Everybody in their cars was listening to our station, trying to figure it out. And at the time, Lieutenant Governor Elizabeth Roberts actually, I don't know if she's saying this, bemoaning it or not. She's like, I can't believe the only way we're getting any information now is through Matt Allen on the WPRO. You know, that was one of the things that was all we had. And that's what we do, you know, and I think that's a need for it, and people like that. So
there is. Yeah, I'm surprised that more people don't call as well. I started calling WPRO, I think it was probably 2016. I started challenging John DePietro, you know, on some of his rants and actually won him over on a few things, which was fun. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's sort of like almost like open mic for broadcast aspiring broadcasters, anyone who's an aspiring or active politician, anybody who has an idea who wants to be able to do more than just type it into Facebook or Twitter. And I'm surprised more people don't take advantage of it, because especially when you have good hosts that are not going to scream over you or hit the dump button as soon as you say something that's not exactly the direction that they had in mind for the show to go.
Right.
You know, it can be a great way to just expand your brain. At least I've had a ton of fun calling in the last couple of years, calling your show, calling Dan, Tara, and even Gresh on occasion, just to give them more time.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things that you have to, it's probably very nerve-wracking for people, because you got to know what you're talking about. And of course, it's like public speaking. Like, you realize there are thousands and thousands of people listening to every word you're saying, and you hope you're making sense. And when you, because you have an opinion on something, doesn't mean that opinion's right or is based in fact or reality. And I'll tell you what, you want your opinions to be challenged quickly, you better have your blank together when you call or get on the air. Because if you don't, if you have a thought on something or a feeling on something, you want to have it destroyed. If it's weak, go on the radio with it.
Exactly, yeah.
And the savage listeners of talk radio will email you, call you, and bombard you with everything, why everything you just said is wrong.
Yep.
And they're probably right. You know? It's one of those things, it makes you really think through what you feel, what your opinion is on something.
Sure.
Because otherwise, they'll shred it.
Do you feel like your listeners right now are, it's a specific daily or at least regular audience that you're, you know, you're connecting with at a first level before you hit whoever is just happens to be listening to the station?
Yeah, I think we all have that. We have, they call them the P1s, the primary listeners of the radio station, who will often, I think, we probably have more of a group of people that will call and interact with you that are more hardcore, that listen every day, that are, you know, that you can count on. But yeah, there's always those people who are the more regular listeners, and they follow you. It's really interesting how something I'll just say off the top of my head, just I think is in passing, that I think nobody pays attention to, that somebody will see me in person, they'll go, oh, I heard you talk about this, and mention they know all this personal stuff about me. Right. I had one woman say, I haven't nailed, when I lived in Tiverton, I haven't nailed down to about two streets of where you live.
Oh, that's a little far.
Yeah. I'm like, yeah. Gonna lock the doors.
I need to look for a Massachusetts plate, though, yeah, when you're pulling in. Right, so, yeah, I mean, it's true. It's pretty extreme, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit, yeah. Okay.
Of course, you choose it, though. You could always go, work on the other side, being a public figure, is, you wear that well, so.
That's tough. That's a weird part of it, too. It's the double-edged sword, right?
Yep.
If people didn't care about you that much, then you wouldn't have a career.
Yeah.
And so we take the good with the bad, And mm-hmm. the most, and 99% of them, fine. It's fine 99% of the time. There's always that 1% once in a while that rears its ugly head, but it's few and far between.
They're out there, believe me. There's maniacs.
They're out there. Yeah.
Working at WPRO and as changes happen, you have a podcast that's not just essentially the past casts of your radio show, but you have a podcast, right, now, long form.
Original content. There,
original content. Yeah. Is that through Cumulus, or are you just doing that on your own? Or
I just started doing that on my own.
Yeah.
Don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
Because I just did it. I just said, I want to do a podcast. I was actually inspired by Joe Rogan.
Mm-hmm.
I started listening to a bunch of my own. The Crime Town podcast is the first one I really listened to. Joe Rogan podcast, I think, is phenomenal. Sam Harris, I listened to. I listened to Jordan Peterson's. I listened to these long-form, in-depth discussions about really important issues and breaking it down and getting in-depth with people and really going into nuance is something that I've been craving for a while. I just didn't know it. And until I started to see that it was possible and that people will listen to it, I'm like, I don't have any constraints. I can do what I want.
Yep.
And the first one I did was with Tim White, and actually I was researching Tim White, and that's when I came upon your podcast.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because I Googled Tim White, and I'm like, what's this Bartholomew? What is this? I never heard of this. And I was like, this is great. You do a great job, man. I was like, this is really interesting. And so I caught, in researching Tim's, I caught yours, and I got some interesting insight to him from that. And so, in the podcasting community, which I don't know if that I'm part of it yet, but I think that there's a lot of cooperation there as well. Everybody kind of, I don't know if it's the same locally as it is nationally, but the podcasters I'm talking about that I listen to, they all cooperate with each other to get on each other's podcasts and stuff. So I don't know what it's going to do to I don't know where it's going to go, whether or not we can do anything with it. That's, make a living off it or not. But for me, it's a way to supplement what I do now in a more meaningful way, in my opinion, because I don't have limitations of stopping for commercial breaks and having time constraints and traffic and weather and all the service elements that we have. I can just talk.
Right. You don't have to do a live read over the ramping up Regan 1 hour heating and air jingle, which is a great song, by the way.
I love my advertisers. Believe me, I am not bemoaning that fact by any stretch of the imagination. It's just the reality of what we do. And we have, I have 3 hours. That's all I get. And I get 3 hours and we have to thank our sponsors need that time too, because that's how we pay the bills. But if I have an opportunity in space to do something else to add to what I can clip that out and use that stuff for the air too, then why not, right? And we get a little extra that way for people if they have extra time after the show is over to turn something on, like on a Saturday night or something like that. If they want to have a longer term discussion about something, we'll do that. And if the advertisers want to sponsor that too, that's, God bless, they can do that too.
Why not? Yeah.
You talk about the freedom of the internet. That's, I think, is a good thing.
Yeah.
Because you have that. Because people listen to it. I don't expect you to listen to an hour-long interview all at 1 hour. Listen to it for 10 minutes and then come back to it later and listen for another 10.
Yep.
Or take a half-hour walk and listen to it half an hour at a time. You know, it's one of those things. And it's on demand whenever you want it.
Yep. Or you can share it as well and have conversations about it with people, which is another huge advantage that you don't get with radio, because you'll miss it. Did you hear that segment? No. Well,
one thing about that, the only thing that's limiting about that is you don't get any interaction with the audience. You could probably get around that, but again, that's a moment in time. It's not, not sitting there whenever they want it to be. It's like, if you could figure out how to do that, I don't know how you'd do that, but.
Yeah, you'd have to broadcast it essentially as digital radio and then have a Skype call-in type thing.
Yeah.
Assuming the audience is listening at that moment, then it's kind of just radio.
Yeah, then it's just the same thing. So
appointment radio.
It's a different animal. Yeah.
Are you ever going to run for office, or you think you're going to be the next Afternoon Drive host?
Afternoon Drive host, maybe someday when Dan York is old and wants to retire and he's done. And I would, sure, why not?
that's where it's heading. But you're super happy with what you're doing.
I love what I do for a living. I love my job. I love talking to people. I love my listeners. I love anybody who gives a damn that I have something to say and cares enough to talk to me about it. I love different ideas. I just wish we had more people willing to, of different points of view, willing to come on and debate things. I think that we, and this is, I'll take my part of my responsibility for this too. I think we have too many people who think a cartoonish vision of what we do, what I do, I should say. I can't tell you about anybody else. Mm-hmm. That they don't think I would be fair to them. And maybe I put that across, but I would love to have these progressives come on the air with me and talk and battle it out with me one-on-one. They get the same amount of time as I have to talk about the political issues, our political points of view, find places where we agree, find places where we disagree. I crave a place where people can be brave. You know what I mean? Come out and let's talk about this stuff and let's open up a dialogue. And I see a lot, especially politicians, they just like to hide. And it's been it's a new thing. The governor does it on our station. She hides from it. I don't think she thinks she needs us. Whatever, fine. Maybe you don't. She got reelected. She obviously doesn't. But it's not a way to run a railroad, you know? So if there are any progressive politicians listening out there, I want to talk to you.
Yeah.
Come into the studio.
Or at least call in.
Debate the issues. Call into the... let's talk about your issues. If I'm being unfair, the listeners will agree with you. Trust me. Yep. So that's one thing I wish I reach out to them, but I don't get much feedback from them. Except for a couple of them.
Do you think talk radio in general is just, in terms of left-wing talk radio, it just seems like a failure from the Air America times through any other attempt to get it going? So I think people just assume, all right, well, we don't do that. It's a right-wing thing.
Yeah.
And also within Rhode Island, I don't know if people pay attention to the fact that you're the only station here. It creates a different, it's a very specific role that you play. You don't necessarily have an ombudsman in terms of another station calling you out.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's not like
the
sports stations where, you know,
which is too bad because I missed that. We used to have that when I first started. WHJJ was a competitor. Had Arlene Violet on there and John DePietro on there, and we battle it out in the ratings, and we go back and forth, and who would be, you know, who'd win and who wouldn't, and it was really good because it kept everybody on their game and working hard and all that stuff. Not that you don't. I mean, most media people are driven that way anyway,
right?
Because, you know, if you're not competing with another station, you're competing with the people you work with. You're competing with yourself. Yep. You're competing with the corporate interests. You're competing with what the next guy who's going to take over your job, whatever it is. But it's good. It's like, you know, that's why there's a Burger King next to McDonald's all the time. You know, that competition's good for everybody. It's the American way. But I do think that there is this concept that I think is overblown, that it's all right-wing talk radio. And I tend to be a more conservative person. I tend to be more libertarian-minded, small government type of person. And I think the reason why most people, why left-wing radio didn't work, is because left-wing thought doesn't work. It's got a lot, in some ways it does, but it has to be packaged in a very specific way, in very small increments, in order for it to make sense to the populace. And if you talk about it and advocate for it, there's a lot of people out there going, what are you, crazy? And by the way, I don't think it's a mainstream thought. You look at the recent study they did about political correctness. They've identified America. This study with like 50,000 ridiculous thousands of interviews and this research project. 25% of America is more of a conservative, extreme conservative political bent. 8% is progressive, left-wing progressive. In the middle there are what they call the majority of this exhausted majority, who knows that the truth lies somewhere on both sides, right? That's the majority of people in general. And so the super left-wing progressives out there, they are a vast minority of thinkers. Of Americans, I should say. And so they should have to prove themselves to the rest of us as to why their ideas are not crazy.
You don't think they do a good enough job articulating it to what you would say is the populist
portion?
No,
they don't. And when they do, they usually use identity politics to justify it. And it's all subjugation, racism, sexism, misogyny, the patriarchy. And it's his fault and their fault. And, you know, you can't comment because you don't fit their mold. And the very thing you'd think that they'd be against, they perpetrate. And so it's infuriating to me.
How can they adjust that to make it so it's policy based in a way
make
that
make it policy based?
Make it is it just that simple? Just there's it, no see, listen, there's nothing more to it.
My idea is to have this Medicare for all. It's going to cost $1 billion. Here's how we're going to pay for it. This is why I think that these people who make more money should pay more in order to pay for it. Here's the benefit. Here's what the actual – and then it actually has to turn out to be that. And then just advocate for it. Say, listen, and go and talk about it. But if it's – you know, you hate poor people and don't want – you want poor people to die of diseases on the side of the road, you're not going to get anybody to listen to you because automatically you've made me the beast or the evil person. So I'm done with you. I don't want to talk to you. You're irrational. I'm not an evil person. I don't hate anybody. I'm not a racist. I'm not. I don't judge anybody by their skin color. I judge them by their behavior. And yours is abhorrent. And I don't want to talk to you. And I don't. You're irrational. And so, if you want to change that, you know, talk about the validity of your ideas. That's all. Use rationality.
That's. I agree that there's just too much reliance, too much leaning on the identity politics, and that creates
it's shorthand. It's quick. It's easy. Right. You talk about shortcuts. It's a shortcut. Just call. Just boogeyman. You know, boogeyman. Your opponent, and that's it. And okay, and that's over. Then the right does it back.
Yep.
And so everybody's a boogeyman. Nobody has different opinions. Everybody's evil. You're trying to kill me. You're trying to kill me. You want to take my freedom away. You want to make everybody die because you're a corporate stooge, and we have America in 2018.
Right. Yeah, that is truly how we've gotten to this point where we're at. Yeah. And Rhode Island, you know, it happens here too. I mean, look at the issue right now in the General Assembly. Certainly, Speaker Mattiello is a very conservative Democrat. That's being, you know, pretty forgiving. He's really a liberal Republican and in terms of his makeup, and you go all the way across the spectrum to a Moira Walsh or in the past Aaron Regenberg, and you know that there's momentum, there's interest behind those ideas, but they haven't found a way yet to go and sit down at the table and marry those ideas with the pragmatic aspects of the people in power.
I think that there is a thing where it's people are drawn to purity. And so these extremists are very pure. They're uncompromising. You know, it's they're easier to admire, to quote Braveheart. Uncompromising men are easier to admire because they stand up for what they believe in. There's no middle ground, whatever. There's none of that. This is what I believe in. I'm going to fight for it. And I'm going to die on this hill. But then they don't, you know, you make enemies of everybody, too. So, yeah, I mean, the focus, I think, if you want to sell an idea, focus on how it can benefit the individual rather than create a group dynamic versus another group dynamic, tribes and all that stuff. It's just toxic. So I don't know. To me, you got to abandon ideas that don't work. I think we also have to understand, too, that not every idea is compromised of good and bad. So we have to first be thankful and recognize, and this is something that I've really learned and been able to vocalize it from listening to Jordan Peterson talk. I don't know if you ever.
I know. I actually don't know. Jordan Peterson? Yeah, I know. I think I've only heard know him because you've mentioned, but I will investigate.
Jordan Peterson is a clinical psychologist out of Canada. He's a professor at University of Toronto. He got into some trouble. If you have time, I can explain this.
Please, yeah.
He got into some trouble because they had changed the laws in Canada to mandate through their human rights tribunal that if you don't call people by their desired pronouns, you are basically guilty of a hate crime.
The person tells you ahead of time, like, hey, I prefer to be a they or he or she, and then you return. Right.
And so they made it like a law. Like, you have to do it because eventually you could be – there's punitive damages that can happen along the way and whatever. And he said for the first time ever in English – common law in history, you were mandated to say something rather than, you know, speech gets limited all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But he said never before in English common law, he was Canadian, this is in Canada,
Were
you mandated that you had to say certain things. And he thought it was a free speech issue. Everybody else thought it was a transgender phobia thing. And so this is how he came to prominence. But then he started to talk about other things. And his whole concept is that we are have a lack of gratitude for the we don't have a long game perspective about our Western society in terms of historical context and the historical context about where we are versus where we were is unbelievable. The Western society that we've created around free speech, the Bill of Rights, right? Free speech, due process, separation of church and state, that concept, all those things were our Western ideas. They have a historical Rome and whatnot.
Sure. Yeah.
But they're adopted by most Western societies, mm-hmm. and they've created the most prosperous nations in the world. Not perfect, but they were, and these lessons and the things that we've learned in order to enact those things, like free speech being important, those are lessons learned over thousands of years of evolution, human evolution. Those are concepts built in the Ten Commandments. Somewhere along the line, he does biblical lectures, the psychological significance of the Bible. It's phenomenal. That we've figured out how to orient ourselves in the world so that we can live. And one of the more recent interviews I've seen with him, he was talking about, they were talking about gender equality. And how one woman asked, I think it was in Sweden, you don't think that that women haven't had the same opportunities as men? He said, no, what I'm saying is that no, pretty much until 1895, nobody had any opportunities at all. That we were cooperating, men and women were cooperating together to keep the wolves at bay, to keep food in bellies and tyrants at the, you know, outside the door. This more often than not cooperated to survive. And roles came out of that struggle that have now literally been genetically encoded in us. And while we try to figure out how to change those roles so that people have equal opportunity, let's not say that we live in a world that's nothing but power struggles and subjugation, because we're trying to figure this out. Let's give ourselves a little credit and not throw babies out with bathwater. And in 50 different ways. And so I think we have this. Mark Hamill, I mentioned Mark Hamill is the actor.
Yep.
He tweeted out a picture of some freshman female legislators coming into the United States Congress. And he said something to the effect of, well, gentlemen, men have been in charge of this country or in charge of running governments for hundreds of years and to middling to poor results. Time to let the women take over completely, I think. Do you agree? And the response on Twitter was absolutely wonderful. To say that we have middling to poor results in Western society in America? Are you kidding me?
That's a pretty narrow view.
You've got to be an idiot.
There's obviously, you know,
the most prosperous. I mean, there's no plague in the streets.
Right.
You know, your sewage gets whisked away and dealt with. My God.
Right. Don't be so hard on yourself. It's like the fundamental flaw to me in religion is that you've got to be so hard on yourself.
Yeah.
You know, that original sin idea. I agree with that.
Start with gratitude first?
Start with gratitude for where we're at as a society, then let's correct it.
Then
let's not be so bitter.
Responsibility for it, right? Now we own it. We are standing on the shoulders of giants,
yep.
right? People who came before us got us this far. Now what do we do with it? How do we make it better? How do we maintain it so we don't make it worse? And nobody thinks of that. Everybody's sitting around. I mean, I don't know how you could sit on your iPhone. I'm talking into a stick right now. A hunk of metal. It's recording my voice, and we're going to broadcast this to whoever the hell wants it
yeah.
across the world. Yeah,
yeah,
this world sucks. It's horrible. What a patriarchal, horrendous thing for. I mean, you got to be kidding. Now, that doesn't mean it's perfect for everybody.
Right.
But for the majority
sure.
of us, it's pretty damn good, or at least not terrible.
It's definitely not going to make the correction that. The end game that would be appropriate, you know, or the goals, I think, of anyone who has that stuff, that's not going to work. In other words, what would work are things like electing people to Congress and, you know, getting people into positions of influence in media or in universities, whatever it is, just in the local communities, you know, and making that not based on gender, making it based on merit.
Making on competence. Think about this for a second. Here you have all these women have been elected to Congress, okay? Because they decided to run, right? They've decided to run. Never before have so many women decided to run. Okay? This isn't because all men decided to take their boots off women's necks. No, they decided to step up and do it. So, once they decided to actually participate in the process, they got elected in. That's a good thing. That goes to show you, number one, women can get elected, and that they have the opportunities that men do to get elected. That was not easily won. That's hard fought. But we have to recognize that it's happened.
Right. We're and at least then, there, and then take a deep right. breath. Right.
I see, and then I see you have all these right. women who are now, it's historic. Black woman does this. Hispanic woman does that. Is a Muslim woman does. All right. Well, what about their qualifications? I'm sure each one of those individuals has all sorts of talents, intellect. And we don't even talk about it. Right. We talk about the stuff that they didn't even choose. They didn't choose to be born female. They didn't choose to be Muslim more often than not. Chances are they're probably born into it, depending. They didn't choose their skin color. But that's what we're celebrating, the stuff that wasn't in their control. What about their genius? What about their creativity? But you don't even talk about it. We don't talk about their competence. And at the end of the day, what's going to save us, their skin color or their competence? Competence is an individual thing. Not everybody has it. You know? Give me one of your guitars there. I'll show you the lack of competence like you wouldn't believe. You know? And if right now somebody said, hey, Bill, guess what? You need to play a tune to save the world. Matt Allen is screwed. Even though I'm a white heterosexual male patriarchy, you know, benefiting son of a bitch.
Yep.
You'd save the world, not me, because you have the talent. So why don't we go with you and not me? Because you're oppressing me? No, because you're better at it than I am. If we can build a society around merit and around competence, then we all survive.
As always, thank you for listening to the Bartholomew Town Podcast. Until next time, I'm Bill Bartholomew. We'll talk soon.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.